The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 2, continued. Cassette 9, Side 2.
On the steamers Druma, Kulu, Nevostroy, Dneprostroy, for which the Krasin was breaking the way through the spring ice, there were also three decks in the cold, dirty holds, and on these decks, in addition, there were two-story bunks made out of poles. It was not completely dark. There were some kerosene lanterns and lamps. The prisoners were allowed up on deck in batches for fresh air and walks. 3,000 to 4,000 prisoners were in each steamer. The voyage took more than a week, and before it was over, all the bread brought aboard in Vladivostok got moldy, and the ration was reduced from 21 to 14 ounces a day. They also gave out fish, and as for drinking water, well, there's no reason to gloat here, because there were temporary difficulties with the water. Here, in contrast to the river transports, there were heavy seas, storms, seasickness. The exhausted, enfeebled people vomited and didn't have the strength to get up out of their vomit, and all the floors were covered with a nauseating mess. There was one political incident on the voyage. The steamers had to pass through La Pérouse Strait, very close to the Japanese islands. And at that point, the machine guns disappeared from the watchtowers, and the convoy guards changed to civilian clothes, the hatches were battened down, and access to the decks was forbidden. According to the ship's papers, foresightedly prepared back in Vladivostok, they were transporting, God save us, not prisoners, but volunteers for work in the Kolyma. A multitude of Japanese small craft and boats hovered about the ships without suspecting. And on another occasion in 1938, there was an incident involving the Churma. The thieves aboard got out of the hold and into the storage room, plundered it, and set it afire. The ship was very close to Japan when this occurred. Smoke was pouring from it, and the Japanese offered help, but the captain refused to accept it, and even refused to open the hatches. When Japan had been left behind, the corpses of those suffocated by smoke were thrown overboard, and the half-burned, half-spoiled food aboard was sent on to camp as rations for the prisoners. Decades have passed since then, but how many times Soviet citizens have met with misfortune on the world's oceans and in circumstances where it seems that Zeks were not being transported. Yet, because of that same secretiveness disguised as national pride, they have refused help. Let the sharks devour us, so long as we don't have to accept your helping hand. Secretiveness, that is our cancer. Short of Magadan, the ship caravan got caught in the ice, and not even the Krasin could help. It was too early for navigation, but they had been in a hurry to deliver labourers. On May the 2nd, they disembarked the prisoners on the ice, some distance from the shore. The newly arrived prisoners got a look at the cheerless panorama of the Magadan of that time. Dead hillocks, neither trees, nor bushes, nor birds, just a few wooden houses and the two-story building of Dalstroy. Nonetheless, continuing to play out the farce of correction, in other words, pretending they had brought not simply bones with which to pave the gold-bearing Kolyma, but temporarily isolated Soviet citizens who would yet return to creative life, they were greeted by the Dalstroy Orchestra. The orchestra played marches and waltzes, and the tormented, half-dead people strung along the ice in a grey line, dragging their Moscow belongings with them. And this enormous prisoner transport consisted almost entirely of politicals who had hardly encountered a single thief yet. And carrying on their shoulders other half-dead people, arthritis sufferers, or prisoners without legs. And the legless, too, got prison terms. But here I note that I am again beginning to repeat myself, and this will be boring to write and boring to read, because the reader already knows everything that is going to happen ahead of time. The prisoners would be trucked hundreds of miles and driven dozens of miles more on foot. And on arriving, they would occupy new campsites and immediately be sent out to work. And they would eat fish and flour chased down with snow and sleep in tents. Yes, it was like that. But first the authorities would put them up in Magadan, also in Arctic tents, and would commission them there too. In other words, examine them naked to determine their fitness for labor from the condition of their buttocks. And all of them would turn out to be fit. In addition, of course, they would be taken to a bath, and in the bath vestibule they would be ordered to leave their leather coats, their Romanov sheepskin coats, their woolen sweaters, their suits of fine wool, their felt cloaks, their leather boots, their felt boots. For, after all, these were no illiterate peasants this time, but the party elite, editors of newspapers, directors of trusts and factories, responsible officials in the provincial party committees, professors of political economy, and, by the beginning of the 30s, all of them understood what good merchandise was. "And who is going to guard them?" the newcomers asked, skeptically. "Oh, come on now, who needs your things?" The bath personnel acted offended. "Go on in and don't worry." And they did go in. And the exit was through a different door, and after passing through it, they received black cotton breeches, field shirts, camp quilted jackets without pockets, and pigskin shoes. Oh, this was no small thing. This was farewell to your former life, to your titles, your positions, and your arrogance. "Where are our things?" they cried. "Your things you left at home," some chief or other bellowed at them. "In camp, nothing belongs to you. Here in camp we have communism. Forward march, leader." And if it was communism, then what was there for them to object to? That is what they had dedicated their lives to. And there are also prisoner transports in carts and simply on foot. Do you remember in Tolstoy's Resurrection how on a sunny day they drove them on foot from the prison to the railroad station? Well, in Minusinsk, in 1940-something, after the prisoners hadn't been taken into the fresh air for a whole year, they had forgotten how to walk, to breathe, to look at the light. And then they took them out, put them in formation, and drove them the 15 miles to Abakan on foot. About a dozen of them died along the way, and no one is ever going to write a great novel about it, not even one chapter. If you live in a graveyard, you can't weep for everyone. A prisoner transport on foot, that was the grandfather of prisoner transport by rail, of the Stolypin car, and of the red cattle cars, too. In our time it is used less and less, and only where mechanical transportation is still impossible. Thus, in one sector of Lake Ladoga, the prisoners were sent on foot from besieged Leningrad to the red cars, nicknamed Red Cows. They led the women, together with the German POWs, and used bayonets to keep our men away from them so they couldn't take their bread. Those who fell by the wayside were immediately tossed up into a truck, alive or dead, after their shoes were removed. And in the 30s, each day they sent off on foot from the Kotlas transit prison to Ust-Vim, about 185 miles, and sometimes to Chibiu, more than 300 miles, a transport of 100 prisoners. Once, in 1938, they sent off a women's prisoner transport the same way. These transports covered 15 miles a day. The convoy marched along with one or two dogs, and those who fell behind were urged on with gun stocks. True, the prisoners' possessions, as well as the cooking pot and the food, brought up the rear in carts, and this transport thus recalled the classic prisoner transports of the past century. There were also prisoner transport huts, the ruined houses of liquidated kulaks, with windows broken and doors ripped off. The accounting office of the Kotlas transit prison had issued provisions to the transport based on a theoretical estimate of the time the journey would take, provided nothing went wrong on the way, without allowing for even one extra day, the basic principle of all our accounting. Whenever delays occurred en route, they had to stretch out the provisions and fed the prisoners a mash of rye flour without salt, and sometimes nothing at all. In this respect, they departed from the classic model. In 1940, Olenyev's prison transport, after disembarking from the barge, was herded on foot through the Taiga from Kniaz Pogost to Chibiu without anything to eat at all. They drank swamp water and very quickly got dysentery. Some fell by the wayside out of weakness, and the dogs tore the clothes off those who had fallen. In Izhma, they caught fish by using their trousers as nets and ate them alive. And in a certain meadow they were told, "Right here is where you are going to build a railroad from Kotlas to Vorkuta." and in other areas of our European north, prisoner transports on foot were standard until the time when, on those same routes and roadbeds built by those earlier Zeks, the jolly red cattle cars rolled along carrying later prisoners. A particular technique for prisoner transports on foot was worked out where such transports were frequent and abundant. When a transport is being taken through the Taiga from Kniaz Pogost to Vesliana, and suddenly some prisoner falls by the wayside and can go no farther, what is to be done with him? Just be reasonable and think about it. What? You aren't going to stop the whole transport, and you aren't going to leave one soldier behind for everyone who falls. There are many prisoners and only a few soldiers, and what does that mean? The soldier stays behind for a little while with the fallen prisoner, and then hurries on to catch up with the rest. Alone. Regular transports on foot from Karabas to Spassk were retained for a long time. It was only 20 to 25 miles, but it had to be covered in one day, with 1,000 prisoners in each transport, many of them very weak. It was expected in cases like these that many would simply either drop in their tracks or else fall behind through the indifference and apathy of dying men. You may shoot at them, but they still can't go on. They are not afraid of death, but what about clubs, the indefatigable beating of the clubs wherever they hit? They are afraid of clubs, and they will keep going. This is a tested method. That's how it works. And so, in these cases, the transport column is surrounded not only by the ordinary chain of machine gunners at a distance of 50 yards, but also by an inner chain of soldiers armed only with clubs. Those who have fallen behind get beaten, as, in fact, Comrade Stalin prophesied. They are beaten again and again, and even when they have no strength at all with which to go farther, they keep going, and many do miraculously get to the destination. They don't know that this is a testing by clubs, and that those who lie down and stay lying down and don't go on despite the clubs are picked up by carts following behind. That's organizational experience for you. And one can ask, why then didn't they take them all on carts in the first place? But where could enough carts be found? And horses? After all, we have tractors. What about the price of oats nowadays? Such transports as these were still common in 1948 to 1950. And in the 20s, transport on foot was one of the basic methods. I was a small boy, but I remember very well how they drove them down the streets of Rostov-on-the-Don without any qualms. And the famous order, "We'll open fire without warning," had a different ring at that time, again, because of a difference in technology. After all, the convoy often had only sabres. They used to deliver orders like this: "One step out of line and the convoy guard will shoot and slash." That had a very powerful sound, shoot and slash. You could imagine them cutting off your head from behind. Yes, and even in February 1936, they drove on foot through Nizhny Novgorod a transport of long-bearded old men from the other side of the Volga, in their homespun coats, and in real lapti, best sandals, wrapped around with onuchi, Russian peasant footcloths, old Russia disappearing. And all of a sudden, right across their path, came three automobiles, in one of which rode the chairman of the Central Executive Committee, president of the Soviet Union, this is to say, Kalinin. The prisoner transport halted. Kalinin went on through. He wasn't interested. Shut your eyes, reader. Do you hear the thundering of wheels? Those are the Stolypin cars rolling on and on. Those are the red cows rolling every minute of the day and every day of the year. And you can hear the water gurgling. Those are prisoners' barges moving on and on. And the motors of the Black Marias roar. They are arresting someone all the time, cramming him in somewhere, moving him about. And what is that hum you hear? The overcrowded cells of the transit prisons. And that cry? The complaints of those who have been plundered, raped, beaten to within an inch of their lives. We have reviewed and considered all the methods of delivering prisoners, and we have found that they are all worse. We have examined the transit prisons, but we have not found any that were good. And even the last human hope that there is something better ahead, that it will be better in camp, is a false hope. In camp, it will be worse. Chapter 4. From Island to Island. And Zexa also moved from island to island of the archipelago simply in solitary skiffs. This is called special convoy. It is the most unconstrained mode of transport. It can hardly be distinguished from free travel. Only a few prisoners are delivered in this way. I, in my own career as a prisoner, made 3 such journeys. The special convoy is assigned on orders from high officials. It should not be confused with the special requisition, which is also signed by someone high up. A special requisition prisoner usually travels on the general prisoner transports, though he, too, meets up with some amazing interludes on his trip, which are all the more extraordinary in consequence. For example, Hans Bernstein was traveling on a special requisition from the north to the lower Volga to join an agricultural mission. He was exposed to all the overcrowded conditions and humiliations I have described, snarled at by dogs, surrounded by bayonets, threatened with one step out of line, and then suddenly he was unloaded at the small station at Zenzevatka and met by one single, calm, unarmed jailer. The jailer yawned, "All right, you'll spend the night at my house and you can go out in the town as you like till morning. Tomorrow I'll take you to the camp." And Hans did go out. Can you understand what going out on the town means to a person whose term is 10 years, who has already said goodbye to life countless times, who was in a Stolypin car that very morning and will be in camp the next day? And he immediately went out to watch the chickens scratching around in the station master's garden, and the peasant women getting ready to leave the station with their unsold butter and melons. He moved 3, 4, 5 steps to the side, and no one shouted, "Halt!" at him. With unbelieving fingers he touched the leaves of the acacias and almost wept. And the special convoy is precisely that sort of miracle from beginning to end. You won't see the common prisoner transport this time. You don't have to keep your hands behind your back. You don't have to undress down to your skin, nor sit on the earth on your rear end, and there won't be any search at all. Your convoy guards approach you in a friendly way and even address you politely. They warn you, as a general precaution, that in case of any attempt to escape, we do, as usual, shoot. Our pistols are loaded and we have them in our pockets. However, let's go simply. Act natural. Don't let everyone see that you're a prisoner. And I urge you to note how here, too, as always, the interests of the individual and the interests of the state coincide completely. My camp life was totally transformed the day I went out to line up forlornly in the carpenter's brigade. My fingers cramped, they had gotten stiff holding on to tools and wouldn't straighten out. And the work assignment supervisor took me aside and with unexpected respect said to me, "Do you know that on orders of the Minister of Internal Affairs?" I was stupefied. The line-up dispersed and the trustees in the camp compound surrounded me. Some of them said, "They're going to hang a new stretch on you," and others said, "To be released." But everyone agreed on one thing, that there was no escaping Minister of Internal Affairs Krugloff. And I, too, swayed between a new term and being released. I'd quite forgotten that half a year before some character had come to our camp and distributed Gulag registration cards. After the war, they had begun this registration in all the nearby camps, but it seems unlikely that it was ever completed. The most important question on it was trade or profession, and the Zeks would fill in the most precious Gulag trades to enhance their own value. Barber, tailor, storekeeper, baker. As for me, I had frowned and filled in nuclear physicist. I had never been a nuclear physicist in my life, and what I knew of the field I had heard in the university before the war, just a little bit, the names of the atomic particles and their parameters, and I had decided to write down nuclear physicist. This was in 1946. The atom bomb was desperately needed, but I didn't assign any importance to that Gulag registration card and, in fact, forgot about it. There was a vague, unverified legend, unconfirmed by anybody, that you might nevertheless hear in camp, that somewhere in this archipelago were tiny paradise islands. No one had seen them. No one had been there. Whoever had kept silent about them and never let on. On those islands, they said, flowed rivers of milk and honey, and eggs and sour cream were the least of what they fed you. Things were neat and clean, they said. And it was always warm, and the only work was mental work. And all of it, super, super secret. And so it was that I got to those paradise islands myself. In convict lingo, they are called sharashkas, and spent half my sentence on them. It's to them I owe my survival, for I would never have lived out my whole term in the camps. And it's to them I owe the fact that I am writing this investigation, even though I have not allowed them any place in this book. I have already written a novel about them. And it was from one to another of those islands, from the first to the second, and from the second to the third, that I was transported on a special convoy basis. Two jailers and I. If the souls of those who have died sometimes hover among us, see us, easily read in us our trivial concerns, and we fail to see them or guess at their incorporeal presence, then that is what a special convoy trip is like. You are submerged in the mass of freedom, and you push and shove with the others in the station waiting room. You absent-mindedly examine announcements posted there, even though they can hardly have any relevance for you. You sit on the ancient passenger benches, and you hear strange and insignificant conversations about some husband who beats up his wife or has left her, and some mother-in-law who, for some reason, does not get along with her daughter-in-law, how neighbors in communal apartments make personal use of the electric outlets in the corridor and don't wipe their feet, and how someone is in someone else's way at the office, and how someone has been offered a good job but can't make up his mind to move. How can he move bag and baggage? Is that so easy? You listen to all this, and the goose pimples of rejection run up and down your spine. To you, the true measure of things in the universe is so clear. The measure of all weaknesses and all passions. And these sinners aren't fated to perceive it. The only one there who is alive, truly alive, is incorporeal you. And all these others are simply mistaken in thinking themselves alive. And an unbridgeable chasm divides you. You cannot cry out to them, nor weep over them, nor shake them by the shoulder. After all, you are a disembodied spirit. You are a ghost, and they are material bodies. And how can you bring it home to them? By an inspiration? By a vision? A dream? Brothers, people, why has life been given you? In the deep, deaf stillness of midnight, the doors of the death cells are being swung open, and great-souled people are being dragged out to be shot. On all the railroads of the country this very minute, right now, people who have just been fed salt herring are licking their dry lips with bitter tongues. They dream of the happiness of stretching out one's legs and of the relief one feels after going to the toilet. In Orotucan, the earth thaws only in summer and only to the depth of 3 feet, and only then can they bury the bones of those who died during the winter. And you have the right to arrange your own life under the blue sky and the hot sun, to get a drink of water, to stretch, to travel wherever you like without a convoy. So what's this about unwiped feet, and what's this about a mother-in-law? What about the main thing in life, all its riddles? If you want, I'll spell it out for you right now. Do not pursue what is illusory, property and position. All that is gained at the expense of your nerves, decade after decade, and is confiscated in one fell night. Live with a steady superiority over life. Don't be afraid of misfortune, and do not yearn after happiness. It is, after all the same. The bitter doesn't last forever, and the sweet never fills the cup to overflowing. It is enough if you don't freeze in the cold, and if thirst and hunger don't claw at your insides, if your back isn't broken, if your feet can walk, if both arms can bend, if both eyes see, and if both ears hear. then whom should you envy, and why? Our envy of others devours us most of all. Rub your eyes and purify your heart, and prize above all else in the world those who love you and who wish you well. Do not hurt them or scold them, and never part from any of them in anger. After all, you simply do not know. It might be your last act before your arrest, and that will be how you are imprinted in their memory. But the convoy guards stroke the black handles of the pistols in their pockets, and we sit there, three in a row, sober fellows, quiet friends. I wipe my brow, I shut my eyes, and then I open them. And once again I see this dream, a crowd of people unaccompanied by guards. I remember clearly that I spent last night in a cell and will be in a cell again tomorrow. But here comes some kind of conductor to punch my ticket. Your ticket? My friend there has it. The cars are full. Well, full in free people's terms. No one is lying under the benches and no one is sitting on the floor in the aisles. I was told to behave naturally, and I have been behaving very naturally indeed. I noticed a seat beside a window in the next compartment and got up and took it. And there were no empty seats for my guards in that compartment. They sat where they were and kept their loving eyes on me from there. In Peribori, the seat across the table from me was vacated, but before my guard could get to it and sit down, a moon-faced fellow in a sheepskin coat and a fur cap, with a plain but strong wooden suitcase, sat down there. I recognized his suitcase. It was camp work, made in the archipelago. Phew! He puffs. There was very little light, but I could see he was red in the face and that he had had a hassle to get on the train. And he got out a bottle. How about a beer, comrade? I knew that my guards were close to a nervous breakdown in the next compartment. I was not allowed anything alcoholic. But still, I was supposed to conduct myself as naturally as possible, and so I said carelessly, All right, why not? Beer. It's a whole poem. For 3 years I hadn't had even one swallow, and tomorrow in my cell I would brag, I got beer. The fellow poured it, and I drank it down with a shiver of pleasure. It was already dark. There was no electricity in the car. This was post-war dislocation. One tiny candle end was burning in an ancient lantern at the door, one for four compartments, two in front and two behind. I talked amiably with the fellow, even though we could hardly see each other. No matter how far forward my guard leaned, he couldn't hear a thing because of the clickety-clack of the wheels. In my pocket I had a postcard addressed to my home, and I was about to explain who I was to my simple friend across the table and ask him to drop the card in a mailbox. Judging by his suitcase, he had been in stir himself. But he beat me to it. You know, I just barely managed to get some leave. They haven't given me any time off for 2 years. It's a dog's branch of the service. What kind? Don't you know? I'm an MVD man, and Asmodeus blue shoulder boards. Haven't you ever seen them? Hell, why hadn't I guessed right off? Peribori was the center for Volgolag, and he had gotten his suitcase out of the Zex. They had made it for him for free. How all this had permeated our life. Two MVD men, two Asmodei, weren't enough in two compartments. There had to be a third, and perhaps there was also a fourth concealed somewhere. And maybe they were in every compartment, and maybe someone else there was traveling by special convoy like me. My fellow kept on whining and complaining of his fate, and at that point I decided to enter a somewhat mystifying demurrer. And what about the ones you're guarding, the ones who've got 10 years for nothing? Is it any easier for them? He immediately subsided and remained silent until morning. Earlier, in the semi-darkness, he had noticed that I was wearing some kind of semi-military overcoat and field shirt, and he had thought I was simply a soldier boy. But now the devil only knew what I might be. Maybe I was a police agent. Maybe I was out to catch escapees. Why was I in this particular car? And he had criticized the camps there in my presence. By this time the candle end and the lantern was floating, but still burning. On the third baggage shelf some youth was talking in a pleasant voice about the war. The real war, the kind you don't read about in books. He had been with a unit of field engineers and was describing incidents that were true to life. And it was so pleasant to realize that unvarnished truth was, despite everything, pouring into someone's ears. I could have told tales, too. I would even have liked to. But no, I didn't really want to any more. Like a cow, the war had licked away 4 of my years. I no longer believed that it had all actually happened, that I didn't want to remember it. 2 years here, 2 years in the archipelago, had dimmed in my mind all the roads of the front, all the comradeship of the front line, had totally darkened them. One wedge knocks out another. And after spending a few hours among free people, here is what I feel. My lips are mute. There is no place for me among them. My hands are tied here. I want free speech. I want to go back to my native land. I want to go home to the archipelago. In the morning, I deliberately forgot my postcard on an upper shelf. After all, the conductor will get around to cleaning up the car. She will carry it to a mailbox, if she is a human being. We emerge onto the square in front of the northern station in Moscow. Again, my jailers are newcomers to Moscow and don't know the city. We travel on streetcar B, and I make the decisions for them. There is a mob at the streetcar stop in the middle of the square. Everyone is on the way to work at this hour. One jailer climbs up to the streetcar motorman and shows him his MVD identity card. We are allowed to stand imposingly on the front platform for the whole trip, as if we were deputies of the Moscow Soviet, and we don't bother to get tickets. An old man isn't allowed to board there. He isn't an invalid, and he has to board in the rear, like the others. We approach Novoslobodskaya and disembark. And for the first time I see Butyrki prison from the outside, even though it's the fourth time I've been brought there, and I can draw its interior plan without difficulty. Oof! What a grim high wall stretches for 2 blocks there. The hearts of the Muscovites shiver when they see the steel maw of its gates slide open. But I leave the sidewalks of Moscow behind me without regret, and as I enter that tower of the gatehouse, I feel I am returning home. I smile at the first courtyard and recognize the familiar main doors of carved wood, and it's nothing at all to me that they are now going to make me face the wall, and they already have, and ask me, last name, given name and patronymic, year of birth. My name? I am the interstellar wanderer. They have tightly bound my body, but my soul is beyond their power. I know, after several hours of inevitable processing of my body, confinement in a box, search, issuing receipts, filling out the admissions card after the roaster and the bath, I shall be taken to a cell with 2 domes with a hanging arch in the middle. All the cells are like that. With 2 large windows and a long combination table and cupboard. And I shall be greeted by strangers who are certain to be intelligent, interesting, friendly people, and they will begin to tell me their stories, and I will begin to tell them mine, and by night we will not even feel like going off to sleep right away. And on the bowls will be stamped, so we shouldn't make off with them on the prisoner transport, the mark Butyr, for Butyrskaya Tyurma, Butyrki prison. The Butyr health resort, as we mocked it last time. A health resort, incidentally, very little known to the paunchy bigwigs who want so badly to lose weight. They drag their stomachs to Kislovodsk and go out for long hikes on prescribed trails, do push-ups and sweat for a whole month, just to lose 4 to 6 pounds. And there in the Butyr health resort, right near them. Any one of them could lose 17 or 18 pounds just like that, in 1 week, without doing any exercises at all. This is a tried and true method. It has never failed. One of the truths you learn in prison is that the world is small, very small indeed. True, the Gulag Archipelago, although it extended across the entire Soviet Union, had many fewer inhabitants than the Soviet Union as a whole. How many there actually were in the archipelago, one cannot know for certain. We can assume that at any one time there were not more than 12 million in the camps, as some departed beneath the sod the machine kept bringing in replacements. According to the researchers of the Social Democrats, Nikolaevsky and Dalin, there were from 15 to 20 million prisoners in the camps. And not more than half of them were politicals. 6 million?
Well, that's a small country, Sweden or Greece. And in such countries, many people know one another. And quite naturally, when you landed in any cell of any transit prison and listened and chatted, you'd be certain to discover you had acquaintances in common with some of your cellmates. And so D, after having spent more than a year in solitary confinement, after Sukhanovka, after Ryumin's beatings and the hospital, could land in a Lubyanka cell and give his name, and then and there a bright chap named F could greet him, "Aha! So now I know who you are." "Where from?" D shied away from him. "You are mistaken." "Certainly not. You are that very same American, Alexander D, whom the bourgeois press lied about, saying you had been kidnapped. And Tass denied it. I was free at the time and read about it." I love that moment when a newcomer is admitted to the cell for the first time. Not a novice who has only recently been arrested and will inevitably be depressed and confused, but a veteran Zek. And I myself love to enter a new cell. Nonetheless, God grant I never have to do it again. With an unworried smile and an expansive gesture. "Hi, brothers." I throw my bag on the bunks. "Well, so what's new this past year in Butyrki?" We begin to get acquainted. Some fellow named Suvorov, of 58. At first glance, there's nothing remarkable about him, but you probe and pry. At the Krasnoyarsk transit prison, a certain Makhotkin was in his cell. "Just a moment, wasn't he an Arctic aviator?" "Yes, they named an island after him in the Taimyr Gulf, and he's in prison for 5810. So does that mean they let him go to Dudinka?"
"How do you know?"
"Yes." Wonderful. One more link in the biography of a man I don't know. I have never met him, and perhaps I never shall, but my efficient memory has filed away everything I know about him. Makhotkin got a whole quarter, 25 years, but the island named after him couldn't be renamed because it was on all the maps of the world. It wasn't a gulag island. They had taken him on at the aviation Sharashka in Bolshino, and he was unhappy there, an aviator among engineers and not allowed to fly. They split that Sharashka in two, and Makhotkin got assigned to the Taganrog half, and it seemed as though all connection with him had been severed. In the other half of it, however, in Rybinsk, I was told that he had asked to be allowed to fly in the far north, and now I had just learned he had been given that permission. This was not information I needed, but I had remembered it all, and 10 days later I turned up in the same Butyrki bath box. There are such lovely boxes in the Butyrki with faucets and small wash tubs so as not to tie up the big bath chambers. As a certain R. I didn't know this R either, but it turned out he had been a patient in the Butyrki hospital for half a year and was about to leave for the Rybinsk Sharashka. In another 3 days, the prisoners in Rybinsk too, a closed box where Zeks are cut off from all ties with the outside world, would nevertheless learn that Makhotkin was in Dudinka, and they would also find out where I had been sent. Now this is the prisoner's telegraph system. Attentiveness, memory, chance meetings. And this attractive man in horn-rimmed spectacles? He walked around the cell humming Schubert in a pleasant baritone. "And youth again oppresses me, and the way to the grave is long."
"Sarapkin, Sergei Romanovich."
"But look here, I know you very well indeed. You're a biologist, a non-returnee from Berlin.
How do you know?"
"But after all, it's a small world. In 1946, with Nikolai Vladimirovich Timofeyev Rasovsky." Oh, what a cell that had been in 1946. The memories of it returned. It was perhaps the most brilliant cell in all my prison life. It was July. They had taken me from the camp to the Butyrki on those mysterious instructions of the Minister of Internal Affairs. We arrived after lunch, but the prison was so overloaded that the reception processing took 11 hours, and it was not until 3 a.m. that, tired from the boxes, I was admitted to cell 75. Lit by two bright electric bulbs below the two domes, the whole cell slept side by side, restless because of the stuffiness. The hot July air couldn't circulate through the windows blocked by the muzzles.
sleepless flies kept buzzing, and the sleepers twitched when the flies lit on them. Some of the prisoners had put handkerchiefs over their faces to keep the light out of their eyes. The latrine barrel smelled acrid. Everything decayed more quickly in such heat. 80 people were stuffed into a cell for 25, and this was not the limit either. Prisoners lay tightly packed together on the bunks to left and right, and also on the supplementary planks laid across the aisle. And everywhere feet were sticking out from under the bunks, and the traditional butyrki table cupboard was pushed back to the latrine barrel. That was where there was still a piece of unoccupied floor, and that was where I lay down. And thus it was that whoever got up to use the latrine barrel before morning had to step across me. When the order, "Get up!" was given, shouted through the swill trough in the door, everything started to stir. They began to take up the planks from across the aisles and push the table to the window. Prisoners came up to interview me to find out whether I was a novice or a camp veteran. It turned out that two different waves had met in the cell, the ordinary wave of freshly sentenced prisoners being sent off to camp, and a reverse wave of camp inmates who were all technical specialists, physicists, chemists, mathematicians, design engineers, all being sent to unknown destinations to some sort of thriving scientific research institutes. At this point, I relaxed. The minister was not going to hang a new stretch on me. I was approached by a man who was middle-aged, broad-shouldered yet very skinny, with a slightly aquiline nose. "Professor Timofeyev Rasovsky, president of the Scientific and Technical Society of Cell 75. Our society assembles every day after the morning bread ration next to the left window. Perhaps you could deliver a scientific report to us. What precisely might it be?" Caught unaware, I stood before him in my long, bedraggled overcoat and winter cap. Those arrested in winter are foredoomed to go about in winter clothing during the summer, too. My fingers had not yet straightened out that morning and were all scratched. What kind of scientific report could I give? And right then I remembered that in camp I had recently held in my hands for 2 nights the Smythe Report, the official report of the United States Defense Department on the first atom bomb, which had been brought in from outside. The book had been published that spring. Had anyone in the cell seen it? It was a useless question. Of course, no one had. And thus it was that fate played its joke, compelling me, in spite of everything, to stray into nuclear physics, the same field in which I had registered on the Gulag card. After the rations were issued, the Scientific and Technical Society of Cell 75, consisting of 10 or so people, assembled at the left window, and I made my report and was accepted into the society. I had forgotten some things, and I could not fully comprehend others, and Timofeyev Rasovsky, even though he had been in prison for a year and knew nothing of the atom bomb, was able on occasion to fill in the missing parts of my account. An empty cigarette pack was my blackboard, and I held an illegal fragment of pencil lead. Nikolai Vladimirovich took them away from me and sketched and interrupted, commenting with as much self-assurance as if he had been a physicist from the Los Alamos group itself. He actually had worked with one of the first European cyclotrons, but for the purpose of irradiating fruit flies. He was a biologist, one of the most important geneticists of our time. He had already been in prison back when Gebrak, not knowing that, or perhaps knowing it, had the courage to write in a Canadian magazine, "Russian biology is not responsible for Lysenko. Russian biology is Timofeyev Rasovsky." And during the destruction of Soviet biology in 1948, Gebrak paid for this. Schrödinger, in his small book, What is Life?, twice cited Timofeyev Rasovsky, who had long since been imprisoned. And there he was in front of us, and he was simply bursting with information concerning all possible sciences. This book is continued on Cassette 10, Side 1.